Welcome to Under the Influence, a podcast for navigating the complex world of disinformation, social media influence campaigns, information integrity, journalism, and the media.
Hello and welcome to May's podcast at the Center for Information Integrity in Africa. My name is Yosibal Chetty, and I am a researcher with the unit. The Center for Information Integrity in Africa stands at the forefront of safeguarding democratic values and societal trust across the continent. Joining me today is investigative journalist Kyle Cowan from Media 24, and someone that I believe to be an incredibly brave human. Kyle's recent articles not only explain the intense process of investigation that was undertaken, but also reveals the identity of a previously anonymous account on X.com, whose content was being amplified by both Donald Trump and Elon Musk. So, Kyle, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a really solid piece of investigative research. Looking at the article from Colony to Gordon's Bay, I can see that there was a lot of open source investigation techniques used. So for those who may not be aware, open source investigation, or OSINT, it broadly refers to free to use tools and publicly available information that can be used to assist in many kinds of research. Kyle, could you please tell us about the investigative techniques that were used and if you made use of any other data or tools?
Yeah, okay. So I have to say I did have help on this. This wasn't completely my own work, but the OSINT sort of expert who helped me with this didn't want to really be named and so on. So they helped us a lot in the initial clues and sort of locating several places. And then I took it the step further and did the verification and, you know, sourced information that would be publicly usable. Because, you know, of course, as journalists, and often with OSINT as well, a lot of information isn't publishable that you find. You know, GPS coordinates, addresses, telephone numbers, ID numbers, that sort of thing. You know, we are prohibited as journalists from revealing that information unless it becomes necessary in the term, you know, and then you have to have a real debate about the public interest of that. So we have to balance that concern with the concern around accuracy, which is always paramount. And in this story, it was quite simple. I mean, so the tools we used were Google Earth, Google Maps, you know, deeds office records, SIPSI records, company records. And, you know, there was a couple. Oh, the other one I used, which is something I use very extensively, is the Office of the Chief Surveyor, or the Surveyor General. They have a website where you can search property by LPI code. And it's something that I do very often to make 100% sure that we're looking at the correct property when we're writing about things, not just based off, you know, simple GPS coordinates and so on. And I don't think a lot of people actually realize that every property record, any ownership of any piece of land in South Africa, all of that information is publicly available. So what we were able to do is through satellite images that Sebastian Yuster had published on his Twitterbox account, with a little bit of help, we were able to identify the exact farm. We were then able to identify other properties that had been owned and eventually track him to his current location in Gordon's Bay. All of this took approximately a day, I would say, in and amongst meetings and doing other things. What I've said before about this particular account is that he posted an extraordinary amount of biographical and geographical information that allowed us really to do this in a much faster way. Usually, identifying an anonymous account like this can, you know, I've unfortunately had to say sorry to quite a few people who've reached out to me after the story, because they have been the recipients of threats from anonymous accounts or threats of doxing, or some of their personal information has been published, or threats of sexual violence. And, you know, some of those accounts, it's just not possible. It's just not possible to figure out who's behind them. And it's unfortunate because, you know, maybe I shouldn't say it's unfortunate. Maybe I should say that in certain cases it's unfortunate because social media is also an enormously valuable tool for whistleblowers. And something that I've come, you know, if you think of sort of like the Arab Spring and, you know, events in countries that have genuinely oppressive regimes. Now you'll hear on Facebook and X in South Africa, you'll hear a lot of people talk about how oppressive the South African government is. And quite funnily enough, being a South African and living in this country means you're amongst one of the more free people in the world. They've never lived under genuinely oppressive regimes where social media becomes a tool effectively for revolution and emancipation from, you know, real tyranny. So we have to find that balance somewhere. And revealing the identity behind an anonymous account is not done arbitrarily. It's not done for shits and giggles. It's not done because, you know, one of the chief criticisms was, oh, we disagreed with what he was saying, and he was critical of the ANC, etc. And I'm rambling, but you know, one of the key things I think is that no, I don't think there's a group of journalists that have done more in terms of revealing information critical of the government than News24's investigation team. And I say this with all due respect to my colleagues, I'm talking about volume. We do an enormous amount of work. And it's something that we're quite proud of. It's something that earns us a lot of criticism. So when we are accused of exposing, because we've exposed one account of being sort of like government agents or whatever, it's quite galling, actually. It's actually quite annoying. It grates a little bit, especially to come back to your original question, when you consider that all of this was publicly available information. It just took a little bit of time to pull it together.
Yeah, I know that. I think that's what really blew my mind when I read the "How Did We Do It" article, and I was like, everything was actually there. You never, like, there was nothing. There was no unethical research. The information was all there. He had put it out on his account. His wife had put some information out on her account that was very revealing. So yeah, the story was there. But you know, it does sound like a lot of work. I know that you said it took a day to do that, but I'm sure that you guys have must have been tracking Twatabas for a lot longer than that, because he's come up in quite a few data sets that I've seen. And so how long did that whole process take you to reach this point of being able to release such an in-depth investigation?
What really took more time was the writing of the story and the presentation of it and ensuring that we have the evidentiary basis for the story, i.e., what really threw us for a loop, and I'll be frank about it, is that Mr. Yuster started deleting quite a lot of tweets. So there was a bit of a race against time to find things. And I can tell you now that there were things that he posted that were far more problematic, and far more revealing. That were deleted, that we weren't able to save in time. But there's absolutely no point in going down that road because there's no record of any of it. So, what actually took a lot of time? I mean, I'm actually pretty sure from the day that so yes, the Twatterboss account had popped up before, but it's never really created much of a concern until in around I think it was the 22nd of March, Elon Musk reposted one of Twatterboss's tweets, and it was a video of Julius Malema singing the Kill the Boer song. And Musk added his own, you know, he quoted the post and added his own interpretation of this onto it. And he said quite a lot. There was some moaning about Starlink in there, but there was definitely what, you know, and part, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but what he said was very few people know that there is a party actively calling for white genocide in South Africa. Now, this white genocide myth has been around for a while. We've all done, as journalists, I think, at one point or another, brushed up against it or had a run-in with someone about it or, you know, have been accused of not writing about it, which, you know, also happens very often. And Elon Musk, who has the single largest follower base on X, making that claim was problematic. But then Donald Trump took a screenshot of that and posted it on his Truth Social account. So now white genocide happening in South Africa is cemented in the eyes of millions of people around the world. If not, if they are not fully convinced, they have an idea that there is a problem. Now, unfortunately, with the way the internet works, you will not find a single resource that can give you accurate information, all of the context needed and the nuance, because saying that, oh, you know, white farmers are being murdered at a rate higher than any other population group in the country, it's easily said. It's much harder to disprove or prove with facts. And in the age that we live in now, it's far easier just to make a, you know, a 8 or 9 minute YouTube video or a 30 second Instagram reel and put that information out there. And, you know, it really is that old cliched saying that I actually hate so much, but it's about, you know, a lie can get halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its boots. And I despise it because it's, you know, it's actually so stupid, but it's also so true. And where we sit as the semi more traditional media, it's much more difficult for us to combat the scale of misinformation around an issue like this. Because when you write an article that is common sense, that is based on established information, you are told that you're towing the government line. And unfortunately, what we're seeing around this particular issue, something quite interesting. The narrative, the conversation is actually driven in the large part by the critics and skeptics of the white genocide narrative. It's not a situation where there's only these right-wing white supremacists who are driving this conversation constantly online. That does happen. But the larger part of the conversation online, especially on X, is happening in rebuttal of that. And in effect, what's happening is that it just drags the conversation on and on and on. But no one is really inserting appropriate facts. No one is really saying, here's one factual basis that we can agree on. Let's debate that. It becomes a mudslinging contest. And I said this in another interview the other day, and it bears repeating, that this issue is actually so sensitive. There's actually a lot of generational trauma linked to the question of land ownership in this country. It is, I think, the starkest example of the other generational trauma that many South Africans have had to live through as a result of apartheid, as a result of the history of this nation just being so racially divisive. And there's never really been a way that I think that we've been able to fix that appropriately or talk about it. So this one, Twitter Boss, and this is a long way of saying to you, Twitter Boss came onto my radar because Elon Musk repeating this white genocide myth. And yes, we'd seen the Twitter Boss account before, but I'd never really opened his page and did a deep dive. In fact,
okay,
a couple of days before that, when I opened his account for the first time, I found out that I was blocked from responding or replying to his things. And it was kind of strange because I'd never interacted with this person on X before.
Yeah.
It didn't prevent me from seeing any of his posts, but it was just...
You just couldn't reply. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being there.
Yeah. And it was just, it was odd because I'd like never interacted with many of these people before. You know, as a journalist, I tend to watch and wait more than engage just off the cuff, because there's a lot of misinformation around this particular issue. But as I started digging a bit deeper into his account, and look, I didn't have to go back very far to find posts that were severely, severely problematic.
Yeah, thanks. I've seen firsthand, and I've reported on also the amplification that takes place by the opposing unit in the social media space. So in 2023, I wrote about Julius Malema coming out and singing the song that got him banned from the ANC, and Elon Musk taking that and then amplifying it. And in fact, All he did was get more attention for Malema's post through that. So I fully understand the nuance that you're trying to speak to there. It's a very important point. So in your report, you also mentioned that Twitter Boss has for years acted as a bridge between South African conservatives and the MAGA right in America. In my own work with Murmur Intelligence, we found bridges from Russia into the South African political discourse, like the Inside Factor account and Modibe Vladimir Modiba, the director for the Center of Information Integrity in Africa, Professor Herman Wasserman. He also did some really in-depth coverage about Russian influence that makes use of buzzers operating in South Africa. On South African social media and in the political discourse. So, between buzzes, bridges, all of these things, there's a lot of jargon going on here. Can you explain, really simply, the concept of a bridge in social media analysis and why it's important to highlight these bridges?
Yeah, so I'm going to keep it very, very colloquial. So a bridge is an account or a series of accounts who regularly interact with two semi-separate communities. So someone who sits in between two, so sort of imagine two poles of a battery. That section in the middle of the battery, that's your bridge. That's your that person, like Twitter Boss, is, for example, a lot of what he tweets. Now, he never actually uses the term white genocide, but what he tweets is feeding accounts that do call it that. So they use his content as an example. And most of these accounts, I must say,
Right.
are part of what we would call the MAGAverse, the Make America Great Again universe in the United States, where white supremacists and white nationalists in America have always held this long fascination with countries like Zimbabwe and South Africa because they are semi-contemporary examples where white rule has failed and the state has struggled to maintain a semblance of law and order or stop corruption or whatever. And it's absolutely pointless pointing out to these people that corruption exists everywhere in the world and even in the most advanced democracies. The way it looks just looks different. It
A
would
little bit
it
more
would
slick.
yeah, it's a lot more suit and tie and
I
sort
was
of
immediately
fancy
thinking
cafes.
Italy, which is why I went a little bit more slick.
And the interesting thing is, like, some of the biggest, just to put this out there, some of the biggest examples of like government corruption in South Africa, the one common theme that they have all running through them, except of course for ANC politicians in South Africa, is global multinational companies, Japanese, French, American. So, this idea that corruption only exists in Africa because people are somehow inferior, which is a real thing, is just, it's nothing more than base racism. And unfortunately, they don't recognize that because I don't think a lot of people have the ability to look at these things objectively, and understand that corruption is usually the product of greed, not race. But anyway, Twitter Boss sits as a bridge, because what we're effectively seeing is he is continuously interacting with what we might call the white right or the conservative right Twitter space in South Africa. Think about your solidarity movements, your AfriForum, and particularly the leaders of AfriForum, i.e. Kali Creel. There's an account, Conscious Caracal, he's now Ernst van Zyl, who's the spokesperson for AfriForum or chief media, whatever officer. I don't know what his official title is. We call him the spokesperson for AfriForum. All very active online, all in that sort of space. Now, Uester interacting with these accounts, obviously doesn't necessarily mean that. That they knew who he was or were supportive of what he was doing or anything like that. And that's just a little caveat we have to put in there, to
Yes.
be accurate and accountable for what we are saying. But it does create a situation where if you map all of this out and if you look at the broader ecosystem that he operates within, you see Elon Musk is a major account on the one side, and you sort of see, your what I mentioned earlier, your anti-white genocide debate community sort of on the bottom hand side, and in between those two things, and the community around Elon Musk is very MAGA positive. So it's your Laura Loomers, it's your end wokeness, all of these sort of accounts that are American accounts who obviously tweet quite a lot about woke, killing the woke mind virus in America and anti-democratic slants.
The
Sorry.
American presenting accounts.
Yes. And if you map all of that out nicely within the context of the white genocide debate, you'll find Twitter boss sitting not necessarily alongside, but within the vicinity of South African conservatives who have made it very clear that despite their concerns, they don't believe a genocide is occurring, and sort of feeding into both of those structures. So that's what a bridge is in this context. And in other contexts, it could be discussions around rugby, it could be discussions around Olympic rowing, which is a very interesting subset of Twitter I once found myself going down into during the Olympics, so we won't talk about that. But
Going.
it's yeah. So you will find, because interests diverge in like within any human interaction. I am a great fan of motorcycle racing. My wife never was, but through constant interaction with me over a period of many, many years, she was drawn into that as well. So now, if you map her interests out, you'll find, a whole lot of music that she loves on the one end, and then the motorbike racing on the other. And she would then technically act as a bridge between those two communities discussing those two topics. That's the best way I can sort of explain it in a way that doesn't
That's a really good way of explaining it. Yeah, I think that's a very like personable way to help people understand exactly what a bridge is. Yeah, because then she could influence people in that music space, be like, guys, cycles are the thing. Let's go watch this race now. Okay, so what is audience capture? And why do you believe it's important for South Africans to know about it?
Oh, wonderful. Anyone who's ever worked in any sort of online media space will know exactly what audience capture is without necessarily having recognized it at the time. But let's say, for example, News24 writes a story of exposing the identity of an anonymous racist Twitter account, and we receive backlash from a certain part of our community or a certain part of our readership. And we then decide that because we are being criticized, because we are being, sort of accused of all sorts of terrible things, we can never do this again. We have to stop, we have to apologize, and heaven forbid that any of these people, never read us again. That would be an example of audience capture in the media space. In the social media space, audience capture is, for example, let's say you post over 2 years, all you posts are cat videos and retweeting, I don't know, funny videos about animals falling off chairs and stuff. Then one day you post a tweet about, let's continue along this example of what we're actually talking about here. You post a tweet about a white farmer who was murdered recently in an area that you might know, or it was someone that your family knew, so on and so forth. And that tweet skyrockets in engagement. You suddenly see that you've gained 500 followers. Your account was relatively small. You've gained 500 followers. A million people have looked at the tweet. You're stirring debates and whatever. And then that gives you a bit of a dopamine kick, right? It's a bit exciting. It's a bit thrilling. And what then happens is over time, your audience starts to condition you to talk about one thing only. Because that's what they want more of. That's what they want to see. They want to hear more about the plight of white farmers in South Africa, which, I think all farmers have many struggles to deal with in this country. And if you're going to continue posting about it, et cetera, and suddenly all of a sudden you have 50,000 followers, then 100,000, then Elon Musk, one of the richest and most influential people in the world, starts interacting with tweets that you post but he only interacts with the tweets that you post about that specific topic. That's going to drive you to post more and more of the same thing because now your audience is suddenly growing much larger. And that process of your audience starting to determine what you talk about, how you talk about it, and when you talk about it, and to whom, that is called audience capture. It's effectively someone pandering to other people what they want to hear, which is everything that the traditional media sort of creates. We are
Because I was thinking,
yeah.
as you were explaining it, I was thinking, maybe it's a pipeline into an echo chamber or something like that. But this is more than that. It's not just a pipeline into an echo chamber. It's
Yeah.
you start. Do you think there's like some sort of conflation between ideology and monetary money making ability?
So to be clear, in terms of X specifically, monetization is not really an option for South African posters right now, based on my understanding of the rollout of monetization and so on. But we do see it on YouTube, we do see it on other platforms, where monetization is a driver of content. So I'm someone who loves motorbikes and cars. I see increasingly channels that I watch about people building cars being sponsored by car companies or, by other sponsors who are like mentioned constantly throughout the video, or you always see it in the video. Now, some people who run these very big YouTube accounts, they are very open about it. They are very transparent about their sponsorships. Others are less transparent. And that is why there's been a recent conspiracy theory, to give you an example, around why we wrote this story, which is that News 24 is owned by Media 24. Media 24 is owned by Naspers, which is a listed company, and one of Naspers' largest CEO shareholders is the PIC. And because the PIC is a shareholder and it's a government entity, that's why we are writing negative things about someone who posts
Or that's
only
why they're
negative.
claiming that you're writing that, rather.
That's how they that's the conspiracy theory. Interestingly, what they then dutifully and on purpose ignore is that, we've written so many stories that are critical of the self-same government. I myself have written articles laying the energy crisis directly at the ANC's door, not just government's door. Specific people within the ANC. I've written books about it, so it's like it's cool, like whatever. But when you tweet something like that and your audience loves it, they're like, oh yeah, that's definitely a reason why these people are going after this poor guy. That is yet another example of audience capture. It comes to a point where some of these online pod bros, whatever you want to call them, or influencers, if you want to use that word, or new age journalists, social media reporters, I don't know what you want to call them. And they are, I think there's a level of there's a level of no turning back. So you've now built your audience. Now you must keep giving your audience the same thing. Otherwise, if you God forbid, have to change your mind. Maybe you're persuaded by a fact or a book that you read or a television show that you're watched, that maybe your belief in something was misinformed at one time or another. It's going to be much more difficult for you because, i.e., you are captured by your audience to go back on that. Now, one of the more interesting things that I found looking at the Twitterbot example specifically is. And this was very central to his identity, that he is a farmer, that he works on a commercial farm. He would tweet on occasion, I am a boer, I will always be a boer, that kind of thing. And the connection there can be twofold. It can either be he means he's actually going to be a physical farmer forever, but in his reference, it's more he's going to be a boer, i.e., that's how he racially identifies as a boer, as an Afrikaner person. But one of the like super interesting things about it is that around about May, June of 2024, the farm where they were staying, he and his family were living in the Eastern Cape, was actually sold. It was owned by his father and his mother, and it was actually sold, and they moved to Cape Town to start running this guest house in Gordon's Bay. He continued to still post old pictures as if they were taken recently or that day. I think, and this is what we say in the story, to continue that farce, that sort of to keep up that appearance that he still lives and works on a farm, because that gives him legitimacy to his audience.
Yes.
And also, right around that time that they were making this major change in their lives, which I'm sure was, a pretty big change for them as a family, Elon Musk started really interacting with his Twitter account. And that's why the term audience capture becomes so important here, because once you have arguably one of the most influential and wealthiest people in the world paying attention to you, it's going to be, and paying attention because you are posting a certain type of thing, it's going to be much more difficult to walk away from that Twitter account and say, I used to be a farmer, I'm not anymore. This was a picture I took 3 years ago. I missed the farm. It would have been much more honest to say that and then still continue to talk about issues confronting farmers, because yes, I think that, having lived on a farm for 20 years, whether it was your farm or your father's farm, having worked on a farm for 20 years, as he says he has, that gives you a level of credibility to talk about issues confronting farmers. Where he sells that short, and this is the point that I think a lot of his defenders miss, by including blatant racism, blatant misinformation, and sort of getting sidetracked by all of these other sideshows, detracts enormously from the message that he's trying to spread. That, he believes, and I think it's a genuine belief that he held at one point or another, or may still do, that being white and being a farmer means that you are subject to a higher degree of risk than any other race group in the country, or any other occupation group in the country for that matter. Now, we could probably do a series of 10 podcasts just talking about that one problem. Because the reality is that, yes, farmers are attacked and murdered. And yes, those attacks sometimes are vicious and horrifying and brutal. But there's a different reality. And that is the reality for people who are not white, who are not black, who do not live on farms. They live in towns and cities. They are murdered far more frequently, sometimes with higher levels of violence and sadism. South Africa is a dangerous country where we have, last year, what was it, 27,000 murders, 77 murders a day. The far bigger problem here is the fact that we as a country and our government and law enforcement agencies are unable to curb that level of violence. That's a far bigger problem for you to worry about. Our high unemployment rate, which means people don't have money, don't have, there are so many people living in poverty. And there are so many people who forget that just owning your own house or owning your own car makes you wealthy in this country. And I think the reason why this debate is so one-sided, other than the obvious answers of racism and lack of understanding and perhaps willful blindness in some cases, the deeper problem here is that the minority who feels most a threat are also the same people who have more access to social media. They have more of a platform. They have more free time on their hands. They can afford devices that can do these things quickly and easily and to a higher degree of, quality. So,
Quality.
yeah, so it's a very difficult conversation to have with someone, to say to them, I understand that you feel threatened. I understand that you feel fear. But don't you think that maybe you're not the only one? It's a difficult conversation to have with someone who starts usually because I work for News 24 and I'm white and they think that I'm Afrikaans because I speak Afrikaans very well. The conversation usually starts with, oh, yes, you left woke, libtard, communist, blah, blah. Like, yes, I'm going to have a rational conversation with someone who starts off the discussion like that, you know. And at the same time, as a journalist, the reason why I think they struggle to find traction within traditional media spaces is because they don't understand how the traditional media space works. They think they do, but they don't. They are very comfortable sort of making a statement like, oh, Kyle Cowan wrote that story because he's a communist. Kyle Cowan wrote that story because he disagrees with what Sebastian Huerta was saying. Now, that's a statement of fact that they make. Neither of those things are true. And if me, in the traditional media, if I made a statement like that about one of them, they drag me to the press ombud very, very quickly. But there's no such similar level of accountability that they subject themselves to.
Yeah.
So this is why it becomes so difficult to compete in terms of narratives. And also why our job in the Fourth Estate remains important. What we don't talk about is if we're changing with the times fast enough. If we can compete with people who have enormous social media followings as fast as they can compete with us. Something to think about.
Great. Those are all such fantastic points. You know, working in civil society, I find myself in a very similar situation a lot of the time. And so I used to be in private sector before. And I was working in media and marketing, which is why I'm now able to understand social media, like the kind of networks and stuff. I've had a good base to start with, having had worked in marketing before, online digital marketing. But when it comes to just, oh, you work in civil society, oh, who's funding you? And it's almost like, oh, okay, well, you're getting funded by them, so actually your opinion doesn't matter. What they don't understand is that we wrote the proposals. So you're not just
you're not just
claiming that there's a corrupt system. You're actually taking a stab at my character. Because you're saying that I'm willing to work with dubious people and nefarious people. And I've had to explain this to people so many times. Just because I've done work for a particular funding agency before, it doesn't mean that they were holding a gun to my head to say that this is what you have to say. Not at all.
It's particularly a criticism leveled by the alternative facts crowd, as I like to call it. They like to assimilate into the sort of westernized, Americanized culture of, yo, you won't tell us what to do. Don't tread on me. You know, I'm a one percenter, blah, blah. But it's like, yeah, you know what? Actually, you're not that much of a rebel, because what you've actually done is you've actually assimilated into exactly what millions of other people were thinking wrongly. So you're actually just part of a different cult now.
Yes.
So there's no independent thought there. And I wonder sometimes why it is that criticism about, and I absolutely hate it when they call South African media houses mainstream media. It's like, no, man, you're betraying the fact that you listen to American podcasters too much. Because in South Africa, if you have a Twitter following of 150,000 people or a YouTube account that gets, you know, more than a million views in a month, you are now the mainstream media. You are now part of mainstream information distribution. They are called the mainstream media in America because they are giants. They reach millions, hundreds of millions of people on a monthly basis, not just in America, but around the world. That's why they are called the mainstream media, because podcasters, etc., while their audiences are massive and gaining ground on traditional media houses, and I'm talking about the States specifically, they are still small in comparison. In South Africa, we have guys with a YouTube channel that reach more people than the local community paper do, who reach more people than some of the supposedly large publications do, and for reasons that we don't have to get into. So that's why I think, even when I hear the term mainstream media, I know exactly who I'm dealing with. It's someone who has adopted the ideas of a different culture, even though we're living all at the same time. The American culture is completely different to the South African context. And they want to try and compare us to those things and say, oh, you're doing exactly what these people do. My favorite one is, you don't hate journalists enough. Yeah, you don't yet.
My
Because,
favorite one is the media won't tell you this. Like,
bearing in mind, so like, for example, a video of Julius Malema singing Kill the Boer, and it's lifted off the SABC's, and it's lifted off the SABC's YouTube feed. Sometimes it may be cropped or whatever. Hey guys, guess what? Guess who owns the SABC? The government. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, the mainstream, mainstream media won't tell you this, but oh, where did you find out about this the first time? Where did you? Bought this idea all
you
by
did.
yourself? Really?
That's another thing that people don't understand is South Africa ranks so high on the Media Press Freedom Index, and we rank higher than America, in fact.
For now. For now.
Well,
Let's not forget that this is the same
hopefully.
ANC government that wants to institute a media tribunal, which, newsflash, my friends, on YouTube and with your podcasts, that would include you too, not just us. So, steady on, and let's try and I think, and this is a plea that will completely fall on deaf ears, because I don't think they'll listen to this podcast, number one, because it's probably going to be too long and complicated for them to follow. And secondly, it's also, let's try and find a common factual basis. It just so happens that I do believe in free speech. I live under free speech every day. That's how I make my livelihood. I happen to believe in it very, very strongly. What I also happen to believe in very, very strongly is that that right to free speech gives you an inherent responsibility. And once you start, interacting with the wealthiest and one of the most influential people in the world, who's literally sitting in the White House almost every day, talking to the most powerful politician in the world, Donald Trump, and you're doing it in conjunction with 159,000 followers on your X account, you have then an inherent responsibility to the facts and to the truth. And I'm speaking as if I've never heard of social media before, because any person with half a brain who has spent any amount of time on social media will know that it is chock-a-block, filled to the rafters with con men, charlatans, grifters, and lies. Right alongside the truth and facts and everything, we as human beings have at our fingertips on these cell phones more access to more information than just a couple of generations ago had in their entire lifetimes. Within seconds, we can access all of that information. Yet we are also one of the most, in my opinion, one of the most gullible generations. And I'm speaking about my age of people who are not yet 35. And it fascinates me. It fascinates me. But what it also speaks to, and this is very important, is that there has been a sustained drive to discredit the media, whether that be the mainstream media in America, whether that be, more traditional media in South Africa. And the reason for that is very, very simple. We have made major mistakes in the past. We make mistakes every day. On the Twitterbot story, I made small errors, small mistakes that were immediately corrected. And we take accountability for those mistakes by saying, phew, this was really an error. We fixed it. This is what we fixed. If it's a really egregious error, we are held accountable by the press council and we apologize for these things. Of course, we disagree on the facts of some of these things sometimes, but when you become a journalist that is subject to the press code, you work at a publication that is subject to the press code, the inherent understanding is that there could be findings against you, even if you disagree with the factual interpretation of that finding. And that's okay. It's okay to sometimes take one on the chin because someone disagrees with you. It's not a hill that you have to die on every time you write an article. But for a lot of people on social media, that accountability is non-existent. They don't have to ever go back and correct anything because their own names are not attached to it. Sometimes they tweet anonymously. That is why when someone is caught doing all sorts of weird things on their Facebook page or on their WhatsApp or on their Twitter, and they are then criminally charged for it or they're held civilly liable, that is why the media reports on it, because there's such a fundamental question around freedom of speech in there. But if I have to start preaching about people needing to be responsible about, you know, with their free speech rights, unfortunately, I'm going to sound like a bit of a crazy person, and it's absolutely futile. So what can we do about it? We can just point out the bullshit every time we see it. And you could probably make a living off just pointing out bullshit online. Unfortunately, as a journalist, you don't have the luxury of time to just sit and do that all day. So,
and you also don't have the luxury of time to just sit and do that because of this entire structure that's being created now, where you're competing with social media news alongside I hate the word traditional media also, but you know, alongside news media houses, and you know, people are like turning there and they want that information. So, Carl, based on a review done by a consultant colleague of mine today, there were about 70,000 posts about the investigation, which means that your article attracted quite a lot of attention. We noticed that Songezo Zibi also took to the X platform to talk about the importance of this work. However, the sentiment from the content shows that there's about a 50-50 split of those that are pro the article and the work that you've done, and those that are against News 24 and the articles about the previously anonymous account. Why do you think your News 24 articles are receiving so much attention? And why do you think some people might be opposed to the articles?
So the opposition is very easy to understand because they've straight up told us why they disagree with the article. They believe that Sebastian Yuster is an innocent man, that we are simply government-backed, jackbooted thugs coming in to destroy this man's life and to put him in danger. They want their followers to believe that the man is a victim, that he has been unfairly targeted, and that the reason why he was targeted was because he was, quote unquote, telling the truth about South Africa to the world. It's a common thread.
Nothing about the account doesn't belong to him or anything, just the fact that he was telling the truth.
Yes. You know, it's interesting to me. Yes, we obviously have concerns around people's privacy, their dignity. We are bound by a press code that makes it very clear that we have to take extraordinary consideration of what is in the public interest before we publish these types of articles. And, you know, the main thing here is that why I think there was so much negativity aimed at us is because of the farm murders debate and the fact that all of this centers around what we touched on earlier, this very sensitive issue around land ownership, land restitution, government steps to do these things, and a very real disagreement within large proportions of our population, be they black or white, Afrikaner or English, about whether or not any restitution is actually owed or whether the government can be trusted to administer such a thing. Because I think the evidence is pretty clear that the government has messed this up royally from day one. I mean, there are how many farms that were paid for and taken, you know, paid for, i.e. to be expropriated or to be given back to communities that are standing empty, that have failed as commercial farming enterprises.
There are examples to draw from, is what you're saying. Yeah.
And you know, it's such a sensitive debate, I think, because of all this misunderstanding and this lack of a clear policy direction from the government. I mean, nobody Nobody believes the government should be able to take your land and not pay anything for it, particularly in such a way that you have no way to fix it, right? It doesn't work for the critics of the story to say that, oh, the journalists who wrote the story might agree with us on one or two things. It doesn't work for them. That's too complicated. Far too complicated. So what they do is, and this is very, very important. There are research papers that have been written about this by people who I believe AfriForum commissioned this, or a subsidiary of some AfriForum company or solidarity company commissioned this. I can't go into too much detail because I don't have it right in front of me right now, so I can't give you the exact name. But there's a research paper that is on AfriForum's website where it talks about civil disobedience and so on and so forth. And then right up towards the end of the paper, somewhere there, it says that without the victim framing narrative, these issues will struggle to gain traction. Now, there are genuine victims of violence on farms. There are genuine victims of government overreach. There are genuine people out there who have lost loved ones in horrific ways. But all of this toxic debate, it's not about that. It's not about getting justice for those families. It's not about highlighting their plight. It's about furthering a con, a grift, an audience capture machine where we get attention for this kind of stuff. We can draw attention to these issues by being as controversial as possible. It's called sensationalism. They accuse us of it every single day. And yes, can the media do more to report more in depth on the farm attacks issue? Yes, but also, can the media do more to report about the murder problem in general? Definitely, yes. Definitely. So, it comes down to it comes down to a couple of things. The criticism exists because it's a very sensitive issue. And it's a very sensitive issue that requires mature resolution, not social media arguments. It requires far greater intervention from the government. It requires a much better understanding of what the concerns are, what drive these crimes. That's why there have been repeated calls for another commission of inquiry into farm attacks and farm murders, which should happen as in tomorrow. Especially now with the attention that we're getting from America, with Trump's attitude towards us, with this misinformation driving, white genocide, he's reposting it, this, that, and the other. We have people who have been researching this topic for years and years and years and years who have directly told people close to Donald Trump there is no white genocide happening. But that myth will now continue to live forever. So we need an impartial, independent, retired justice to sit at the head of a commission, take evidence, do investigations, have subpoena power, get
Oof.
this thing investigated properly once and for all. Give us, as South Africans, give us all a solid factual foundation to start this conversation off from. Then we can start having a real conversation about what are the drivers of these crimes? What is the impact of this? What can we do to fix this? Why isn't it that farms that are handed over after being, taken away from farmers or paid for? Because let's be clear, no land has been taken from any farmers yet. But now we're saying all these farms have failed. Why? Why are these farms failing? Is it a funding issue? Is it a knowledge transfer issue? Is it a skills transfer issue? What is going on here? Why can't we, as a country that has so much arable land, not figure this problem out? Why?
It's reminiscent of the xenophobia and spaza shop narrative, where you're
That's
trying to sell to South African black people that you are only deserving of this 0.3% of the info that of 0.3% informal economy that contributes to the GDP, rather than saying, hey, come play in the whole other 97% that we have. Let's try to figure that out. But you see, once you start talking about commissions and stuff like that, people then are going to go, well, the resources. So now you're taking the resource, where are you taking the resources from to be able to do this investigation? And so
yeah.
that's, there's always these counter narratives and so on that continue to spread.
It makes it very, makes it very difficult to enter this conversation rationally. And I think that's exactly where journalists such as myself, this is the space that we live in. This is the space that we are supposed to be in. So as much hate has been given my, been thrown my way or whatever, I'm going to carry on doing my job. It's not going to dissuade me from writing about these things. It's not going to, criticize me for the story. Fine. Criticize me for something you disagree with in the story. Fine. But when you start acting the way that people have in response to this story, that's when my bullshit detector starts going haywire, because this isn't a normal reaction. From what I'm seeing, there's something else going on here. What exactly that is, I've got some rough ideas. We'll be looking at it over the next couple of weeks. I've been accused of being a coward and running away for not engaging on social media, for example. But they forget social media is not my platform. My platform is News24. So you'll be hearing from us soon, but it's probably not going to be something that they like very much, because it doesn't really matter what they say and do. We listen to valid criticism. What I'm seeing now is not valid criticism. There's a determination to tarnish News 24 and me and my editors from a very select group of online people. And I'm not really sure what the motivation is. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe the criticism could be valid in the long run. At this point, I haven't seen any bit of criticism that has given me any pause about our story. And that's simply because people are not engaging with the content of the story. They're engaging with
The
broad stroke.
headline.
And they also, what's also very interesting is that the blatant racism and hate speech, it's just being ignored completely. It's just being
In the
ignored.
comment threads.
It's being
Not
ignored. And
it's not only the primary posts, it's in the comment threads. When you see the kind, and they know when it comes to racism, when it comes to foreigners, immediately those comment threads get flooded out, not only by the buzzers and the influencers that are working within their mechanism to try and make this look like a more important story than it actually is,
by
but
any critic
also
of the media.
by people, by your standard South African. And I think that's where our concern comes around with the idea of information integrity and building a more resilient South African online social media community whose bullshit receptors also start to go off a lot sooner than they should, like yours do. So, Kyle, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
I
you.
appreciate you doing this with me once again. And yeah, I look forward to seeing what else you guys have to put out and what comes from this.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure.